Welcome to Veritas Church. It's good to be here, even in the exhibit hall. Like, we have a place to worship. We're free to worship Jesus this morning, but we are excited a year from now to be in our own building. So that's an exciting day that we're looking forward to. But this morning, we have the privilege of hearing from God's Word from 1 Peter chapter 3. If you have a Bible, open it up on your app or follow along with us on the screens. Finally, all of you, have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless, for to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. For whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it, for the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous and his ears are open to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Now who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame, for it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. This is God's word. So 2 weeks ago, after I preached, I had an awkward moment. It was one of those moments where I was asked the question, "Do you know me?" And I had never met this woman, but it was like I knew her as I was talking to her. The way she looked, the way she talked, her mannerisms. And then she said what connected all the dots for me. She said, "I'm Teresa's sister." And it was like, oh yes, Teresa's sister. I can see Teresa in you, unmistakable. Have you ever noticed this? Every family has a family way, right? A way they talk, a way they carry themselves. Do you know your family way? I know mine, the errant family way, the way that's been inherited from forefathers, right? And that the errant family way, I guess errants might be known as being a little bit cheap. My kids were with my parents on a road trip. And the question was, why do grandma and grandpa drive all over the city to find gas that's 3 cents cheaper? It doesn't make any sense. Well, it can only be explained by errands are a little cheap. My grandfather was looking at the cost of caskets and realizing that when he passed away, this would be a big expense. And so he said, "Hey, when I die, freeze me with my legs crossed and screw me into the ground," right? Like, a little morbid, right? But I don't want you carrying the cost of this casket, right? Pretty cheap, but we also have good qualities about us. We tend to be relaxed, very relational, we're outgoing, spontaneous, which is a nice way of saying we're unorganized and we live by chaos, right? And often our lack of planning ends up becoming someone else's emergency. You know these people, that's us. And they say that ulcers are stress-induced. Well, it's been said of the errants, they never get ulcers, but they give them to a lot of people. Okay, so that's our family way. That's our family way, the errants. Now, here's the point. Every family has a family way. Christian, do you know our family way? We bear the name Christian. Do you know our family mannerisms? The way we talk, the way we carry ourselves. Peter has been teaching us our family way. And in verse 9 of our text, he says, when you are reviled, when people criticize you in an abusive way, here's the family way. We bless those who revile us. To this, you were called. That's your calling, to bless those who hate you and criticize you. And he comes back to this idea that he started back in verse 21 when he said, for to this you have been called because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. And we've been talking about this word. Example is the idea of the writing underneath. It's the pattern to trace over. That's the idea in Greek. And he's saying, put your life over the pattern of Jesus and just start tracing. And he says, this is what our calling is. People are supposed to see us and through us say, oh, that's what Jesus is like. And he's been going through talking about citizens, servants, wives, husbands. And now in verse 9, he says, finally, all of you. This passage applies to every single person in this room. All of you. Here it is. Have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. This morning we're talking about our family way, and there's four things I want you to know about our family way. Number one, care deeply. We, as Christians, care deeply. This comes from verse 8. He says, He bookends this list of virtues with, he begins it with unity of mind, and he ends with humble mind. Now, here's what he's saying. There's something beautiful when a group of people display unity. We saw this yesterday, right? A team working perfectly together as one is a beautiful thing. And he's saying, when people see Christians unified, it displays Jesus and his kingdom and his family. But he makes a statement, I want you to have unity of mind, but it's going to require humble mind. So to have unity, you have to have humility, he says. So I ask you this question. Are you a divisive contrarian kind of person? Are you someone that is difficult to lead? When someone has an idea, your immediate response is to think of all the reasons it's a bad idea, to object. You always see insincerity in other people. You always think other people or organizations are disingenuous, and you're always kind of negative about what's going on. Or are you a team player? You're a gamer. You're a can-do. Let's do this. I'm a part of this. I have to confess, my struggle as a leader is that I can tend to be a difficult person to lead. I was at a conference this weekend, and this was exposed in me. I'm at this conference, and I'm listening to the speaker, and I'm just like, this is so boring. Why did they have this guy lead off, right? This is, you know, here we are, and I'm just, you know, pull out my phone, I'm going through my Twitter feed, seeing what's new on social media, and I'm just have this bad attitude. And have you ever noticed this? It's always easiest to lead whatever you're not leading. Have you found that to be true? Like, you're not leading it, and you know exactly how it should be led. But when you're the one in charge, all of a sudden you realize the complexity of the situation, and you're slow to give others the benefit of the doubt when they're doing something that you're having to follow. But when it's you, you give yourself a ton of grace. And so yesterday morning and this morning, as I'm studying this, I'm like, I am repenting on my knees of my own arrogance. Peter is saying, that is not the family way, to show up to a family reunion, a family conference, and to criticize. That is not the spirit of Jesus. being displayed in my heart. We are a people, he goes on, who are sympathetic, sympathy, tender heart. This is so fascinating when he uses this word, tender heart. It's the Greek word for your guts, your inner organs. He said, and so what does he mean by that? Like in Greek thought, your guts were associated with courage. We even have that phrase, like, they've got guts. And what we mean is they've got courage. But Peter takes that word and he uses it differently. He uses it to mean mercy. That word's translated compassion. Like when somebody is hurting, you feel it in the deepest place possible. You know that place when somebody's hurting, you're like, no, God, and you weep with those who weep because you feel it deeply. And he uses this word sympathy. This is the idea in 1 Corinthians 12 when Paul says the church is a body. And when one body part suffers, they all suffer. You know, when you stub your toe, your hand doesn't say, well, at least it wasn't me, right? When you stub your toe, it's like your whole body's like, ow! Your whole body hurts for your toe. It's just your toe. Who cares about your toe? But your whole body hurts. And he's saying, this is what our family is like. When one part is hurt, we all hurt with them. When one part rejoices, we all rejoice with them. This is our family way. So my question to you is, in application to this, how quickly do you mourn with those who mourn? How quickly do you rejoice with those who rejoice? And are you a team player or are you a squeaky wheel? Something's always wrong. You can never be satisfied. And then he ends with this idea of brotherly love. This is the virtue that brings them all together. Earlier in chapter 1, he said he's given us new birth into a living hope. So new birth means we're a part of a family. So do you treat people in your connection group, the people in this room, as family? Because that's what we are. We are brothers and sisters. And the people in this room are more your family than maybe your biological family that doesn't know Jesus. This is a picture. He goes on in verse 9, do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless, for to this you are called, that you may obtain a blessing. Our family way, number 2, write this down. Number 1 was we care deeply. Number 2, we bless relentlessly. You know what it means to be relentless? It means you are persistent. You never stop. You never quit. Definitely, one of our distinguishing family traits. You can always tell a Christian by their kindness to people who hate them. So you've heard the phrase, don't get mad, get even. In our family, here's how we get even. We bless. We say kind words in response to mean words. And he gives the reason here that we're able to bless those who revile us. He says, on the contrary, bless, for to this you were called, listen, that you may obtain a blessing. So what's our motivation for blessing those who curse us? The motivation is our eternal reward that's coming. Peter's saying, this is not the end. What happens here on this earth is not the end of the story. This is the reason that we are able to bless. In Luke chapter 6, this idea of blessing those who revile us, I think, Peter is referring to Luke chapter 6. Let me just read it for you. I'm going to come up on the screens, Luke 6, 27. This is the pattern that Peter's calling us to trace over. He says, but I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. To the one who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from the one who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. Give to everyone who begs from you. And from one who takes away your goods, do not demand them back. And as you wish, that others would do to you, do so to them. There's the golden rule. Verse 32, if you love those who love you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you are good to those who are good to you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. If you are new to Christianity, here's what you need to know about God. He is kind to ungrateful and wicked people. Have you ever noticed when it rains, it just doesn't rain on your lawn? It rains on your neighbor's lawn too. And people who don't believe in God get to enjoy all the blessings of this life: wealth, prosperity, beauty. And that's what God is like. He blesses wicked people. And Jesus says that is how you will be known as sons of the Most High, when you live out our family way to bless relentlessly. Now, this raises an objection. I don't know if any of you are thinking this, but I'm thinking this. I'm reading in the middle of listening to Uncle Tom's Cabin, and I am telling you, it is wrecking me. And I would commend that to you and say, that's the best $2 you'll spend this week, and listen to that. And it's causing me that kind of gut level kind of compassion. And my objection is to what Peter's saying and what Jesus is saying is, so you're telling us just to ignore evil? You're telling us just to bless those who persecute you? Like, we're just supposed to turn a blind eye to this injustice that's happening? Is that what Peter's telling us? No. Because when you bless someone who hates you, that does not diminish the evil. It shines a spotlight on it in a way that just might lead someone to the cross, to find the same grace that found you. Here's the pattern to trace your life over. As Jesus was crucified on the cross, he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing. So Peter quotes Psalm 34. He's already quoted from this earlier, and he comes back to it. Whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil, his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn from evil and do good. Let him seek peace, pursue it. The eyes of the Lord on the righteous, his ears are open to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Here's what's interesting about what Peter does. Psalm 34 is a beautiful chapter about fearing God more than our circumstances. It's about how God rescues people in trials. Psalm 34 would be a great chapter to memorize. If you need hope this week, open to Psalm 34 and memorize it. He quotes it, but here's the tension that I have. Peter quotes from Psalm 34, but he leaves out Psalm 34:17, which says, The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears them. He delivers them from all their troubles. Here's my problem with what Peter's doing. He leaves that out. The psalmist says that when righteous people call out to God, God delivers them. And I'm telling you, there have been times that I have cried out to God and he has not delivered me. And some of you are in situations where you cried out to God and he did not deliver you. And he did not cure your sickness. And he did not deliver you from that trial. And this whole epistle, Peter has been saying that God brings us through trials. Seems like this is the whole point of his epistle and letter, is to say, God doesn't deliver you. And that's when he gives you the persevering faith to get through it. And so he just leaves out Psalm 34, verse 17. But if we go back to the psalm and see what verse, what other verse Peter left out that comes right before what he quotes, it's Psalm 34, verse 11. It says, "Come, my children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord." Psalm 34, as it turns out, is a psalm about fearing God more than you fear your circumstance. Fearing God more than you fear your sickness. Fearing God more than you fear your enemy in front of you. So now look, with that context of Psalm 34, look how that flows into Peter's line of thinking here in verse 13. He says, "Now, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good?" So he just left off, God will deliver you from all your troubles. But instead, he replaces that with this question. Okay, so who is there to harm you if you're zealous for what is good? If you're pursuing Jesus, who's gonna come against you? Verse 14, "Even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled. But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy." Our family way is to care deeply, to bless relentlessly. Number three, to fear God only. Here's how God will deliver all of us. The final judgment. And you know what the psalmist says about God's throne? He says, "Righteousness and justice are the foundation of God's throne." And Peter is saying, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? I want to go back just to Luke 12. I want you to see this from Jesus, Luke 12. Because I think this is where Peter's getting this idea, Luke 12, 4 through 9. It says this. Jesus says, "I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body, and after that have nothing more they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who, after he is killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies, and not one of them is forgotten before God? Why, even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, you are of more value than many sparrows. And I tell you, everyone who acknowledges me before men, the Son of Man also will acknowledge before the angels of God. But the one who denies me before men will be denied before the angels of God. If you are afraid of people who can hurt you, if you are afraid of getting sick and dying, if you have a fear of those things, or whatever fear you may have in this life, then you have factored God out of the equation of your life. And if you take God out of the equation, then you should be scared, right? But if you put God in the equation, that fear of God trumps everything. Jesus says, you're worth more than many sparrows. God knows the number of hairs on your head. God is for you, and he's all powerful. And the way to conquer fear is by a greater fear, and that is the fear of God. Drew Stevenson, the pastor, former teaching pastor here at Veritas that just this fall left with the team to plant Salt City Church in Minneapolis, tells this story. He told this story at their kickoff. I thought it was so fitting. He was as a kid, he was on a walk with his mom and dad, and they were attacked by a vicious dog. And this dog comes running at them. And Drew's dad ran toward the dog and just went off on this dog. And this dog put its tail between its legs and ran off. And Drew said, I have never seen that come out of my dad before. But something that my dad loved was being attacked. Do you see how you conquer fear by greater fear? Drew said, in that moment, I feared my dad in the most beautiful way because I knew that my dad was going to protect me from anything that was going to harm me. And in verse 17, he says, for it is better to suffer for doing good. Listen, if that should be what? God's will. God is in charge of the suffering in your life. Nothing, listen to this, nothing can get to you that hasn't already gone through him. He has to sign off on any suffering that comes your way. Did you see that from verse 17? It is better to suffer for doing good if that should be God's will. I was talking to Patty, has been bringing some food into the office, blessing our office, and she'll bring in some chips and salsa, and she comes in, we were talking. She goes, oh yeah, I was reading this book, and it's on suffering, and this pastor was talking about this old lady in their church, and she said, Pastor, I'm starting to have a hard time figuring out the difference between a trial and a blessing. Because they seem like God has been so good to me through my life. And that's a beautiful picture. Nothing gets to you that hasn't gone through him. So we're building a building. We're excited about that. And I'm also excited about the person who's leading the charge on the building. So we got Dale Mulliken, and Dale pulled in Jim Walker. Okay, so basically, here's the deal. Jim Walker is the man. You've seen Jim up here, and here's what I want to say about Jim. Nothing gets through him.
He sees all the details, and he shows up to a meeting. He's got a stack of papers, and he knows every detail of every word that's in that stack of papers. Nothing gets by Jim, and he's looking at the plans of fire hydrant here. Now, wait a minute. Let's put that fire hydrant over here. Code says it can be here. Saved us $15,000, okay? The details don't get by Jim. That's good news. Now, if it's in the building, it's because Jim said it should be there. He's the superintendent. Nothing gets through him. Now, your life is a construction zone. And guess who the superintendent is? Not Jim, okay? Jesus! Jesus is the superintendent of the construction zone in your life. He's making you more like Jesus. We see in Job, Satan has to get permission from Jesus to inflict suffering on Job. Amazing story. Satan's definitely on a leash. And so the difference, I think, between new construction and what's happening in our life is that our life is a bit of a remodel project, right? God's not starting from scratch, this beautiful piece of land, right? He's having to remodel, which means some demolition. I know in my heart, it's like, no, don't take down that wall. You know, it's like stuff's getting torn down so it can be rebuilt. And God's doing this beautiful work in all of our lives. And we can submit to suffering because God is good and God is in charge. And there will be a resurrection. There is a living hope in the midst of our trials, as he had talked about in chapter 1. So Peter goes on. And this is the final point here in verse 15. I want you to see this. He says, I want you to be prepared to give an answer. As in your hearts, honor Christ, the Lord is holy. Always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect. He ends by saying, Christian, you need to be ready to give a reason for the hope that's in you. And this word reason is apologia. Does that sound familiar? Where we get our word apology. He's saying, always be ready to give an apology. But he doesn't mean say, I'm sorry. It's the idea of giving a defense, giving a justification, giving a reason. You've heard of the term apologetics. It's the discipline of defending the faith. Our family way, we care deeply, we bless relentlessly, we fear God only, and finally, we're always ready. We're always ready. We're always ready to share the good news. We're always ready to tell someone the good news message that can give them hope in any circumstance. That message is always on the tip of our tongue, and we are ready to give a reason for the hope that we have. Now, you would think from the way you see some Christians talk and from the way you see Christians interact online and whatever, you would think that Christians have been called to get in arguments. That's not what Peter's saying. I mean, here he says clearly, do so with gentleness and respect. When you're talking to someone who's hating you and bashing the Christian worldview, you respect them. You are gentle in the way you respond. Sometimes how you say it is as important as what you say, but giving an answer always requires what? Words. Always be ready to give an answer. Peter's saying, there are going to be times you're going to have to say something. You can't just be a secret service Christian. Oh, people will get saved because they see my good deeds, right? No, he's saying, you're going to have to give an answer. You're going to have to use words. And since they're asking for a reason, you're also going to have to use logic. Why are you a Christian? Well, I just feel it. That's not a great reason. Right? I was sharing with some of my friends that are in what I would consider a cult. And they talk to me and they just read our holy book. And you'll just feel it when you're reading it. And you'll just know that it's true. I'm like, that's a bad reason. Yeah, you don't worry about the history and all that. Just read it and you'll just feel it. That's not what Peter is telling us we should do. So I ask, do you have a defense for your faith? Can you explain to someone why you are a Christian? You don't have to shut your mind off to science and philosophy and the arts. You can believe because it's true, because the evidence points to this. Now, if you're new to the faith, I want you to be encouraged for a minute. I don't want you to be too discouraged by what I'm saying, because I think that Christianity is like riding a bike. Okay, you know how to ride a bike long before you know why you can ride a bike. Does that make sense? Like any, you know, 4, 5, 6-year-old can learn how to ride a bike, but they can't explain to you all the laws of physics that allow them to ride a bike. You know, gravity, friction, centrifugal force as they're turning, and resistance of wind, and all those things. You don't have to have a PhD to ride a bike. And some of you in this room are like, well, I don't know. Like, my reason for being a Christian is I'm a sinner and Jesus is my only hope. Or I know that I was dead and now I'm alive. Is that good enough? Yeah, that's a great reason, okay? But I'm encouraging you to understand why you are a Christian. And when someone starts talking about science, you don't have to be afraid. Like, God invented that. All science is it's the study of the faithfulness of God and how he upholds the universe. Okay, you can be a Christian and pursue knowledge and pursue reasons. I would encourage you to start by grabbing a good book. My favorite book, I brought some of my favorite books. My most favorite book outside of the Bible is this book, Mere Christianity. I will not lend you this copy because it's the only one left on my shelf. Usually I have 2 or 3 copies of this book on my shelf because I plan on giving it out to someone. Chapter 10 is my favorite chapter outside of anything in the Bible. It's the chapter on hope. It's where C.S. Lewis uses the argument for God from desire, that statement where he says, if I find in myself desires which nothing in this world can satisfy, I can only conclude that I was made for more. That's a beautiful chapter. And this book by C.S. Lewis is a great place to start. I think basically this book in modern day English is Reason for God, maybe a little bit more accessible than Lewis, but this is by Tim Keller, and you should definitely pick this up. This was a New York Times bestseller. Pick this up. First person who comes up afterwards and wants to borrow it, you can borrow this book. And this is a book that Doug Boatman, he's always given me good books. This is Tim Keller's other book on apologetics. It's called Making Sense of God. This would be a great book for you. And if someone talks to you and you don't have a good answer for your hope, guess what you should say? I don't know. I'll look into that. Like, it's okay to not know, but to say, I'm going to go check into that. And hey, would you want to read a book together? This would be a great one. Making Sense of God would be a great book for you to read, and maybe you to read with someone who has no desire to be a Christian, but maybe would be willing to jump into that book. So, family, Christian, here's our family way. We are a people who care deeply, who bless relentlessly, who fear God only and are always ready to share the good news. When people see you, do they see what family you're a part of? It's appropriate for us this morning to end our time with communion, because here's what I can say about my life this past weekend. I have not lived out in my words, in my actions, the family way. That's why we take communion, because there is not a single person in this room who can say, oh yeah, I've totally done all those things. Like, I think you're gonna have great connection groups this week, right? There's a lot to talk about here, but I'm telling you, there is not a single person in this room who can say, oh yeah, I'm good. And here's the good news, like, your failure is what qualifies you for grace. If you were worthy of this, then it wouldn't have needed to happen. Jesus broke his body on the cross, symbolized through the bread, and he shed his blood, symbolized through the juice. Let's do this in remembrance of him. Would you bow your heads with me? As the worship team comes up, I just want to give you a moment of silence to reflect on this message. Just invite you to turn your eyes upon Jesus right now. Go follow Jesus to Calvary and see him. The cross is empty now. There's an empty cross. And Jesus is alive. Just come to him. Turn your eyes to him. And when you're ready, come to the table and do this in remembrance of Jesus Christ, was crucified, was buried, and raised from the dead for your life and for your resurrection.